Great to be with you today. And today you're really getting Andy's open door because my guest is named Andy too. So we got two Andys today. So we're lucky to be joined by Andy Seward today, who is our Chief Information Security Officer. And he's got a really important job and really important in helping protect all of us and all of our patients as well. So excited about that. And as usual, I've got Caroline with me as well, who's going to be helping us out today. Caroline, how are you?
I am fine. How are you today, Andy?
Doing okay.
I know I have a lot of questions for Andy Seward. I was teasing him beforehand as someone who needs to get information out as part of my job, and he's someone who's in charge of keeping it in. It's always a fun struggle, so I'm really looking forward to hearing more about information security because also it's just a super important thing that we all do need to worry about because patient information is sort of the name of the game here. If anyone else has questions for Andy Seward, or for Andy Mueller for that matter, please just pop those in their chat, the first and last names and pronouns. As always, we also got some email questions in advance of the program, so we'll be talking about some of those too. But Andy's, I would love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, how are you going to keep us straight? How are you going to differentiate between the two of us?
I think I'm going to have to be like Andy S, yeah, Andy M. Isn't that what they do like in elementary school when there are like five Jessicas?
I was never really in a class with other Andys, were you?
Yeah. No.
So it would be kind of a new experience for us.
I had Carolyn's.
Yeah.
Carolyn and Caroline, and we all just, you know, would go back and forth because people would use each other's names for each other, but. Anyway.
I can imagine.
Gotcha.
Well, good. Well, Andy, thank you for being with us
Pleasure.
Today. Yeah, we're really grateful to have you. And this is a really important topic. And, you know, people will sometimes ask me, you know, Andy M. is the CEO of Maine Health. What keeps you up at night? This is one of the things that really does keep me up at night in all seriousness, for sure. So before we start talking about the risk to the organization and some of the things we're doing to try to mitigate that, Andy, would love to learn a little bit about yourself. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you started getting engaged around cybersecurity.
Well, I mean, I'm not that important or special or different. I'm just a normal human being who came into this in the usual way. We sort of walk into it over a period of just growing up and going to certain places. I'm a Virginia boy who went off to college and ended up going into the Army and was planning to do 3 years there, ended up doing 27. And when I got out, I had been coming up here and said, wouldn't this be a great place to be? And so I started off in healthcare. And I've been doing IT for some time, a different series of jobs leading IT teams. And I got interested in security. This all started around early 2000s when we started to see more hacking, we started to see more scams, and it just seemed very interesting work to me. And so I ended up in this space, and I'm happy that I ended up here at Maine Health. It's a really great time to be at Maine Health. We're going through a lot of technology changes, and I've got a fantastic team, and so I just feel very fortunate to be here. But again, there's really nothing special about me, and so for those of you that are out there, if you have kids that want to get into this business called cybersecurity, it's a very good place to start in IT these days, and I think that it'll be around for a while.
Yeah, Andy, and thank you for your service in the military.
Oh, glad
and
to do it.
As a fellow vet, I was always impressed during my years of service just how seriously the military took cybersecurity. It was very much a part of our culture, probably more than I've experienced in healthcare, but that's probably okay because, I mean, after all, healthcare systems don't really get attacked that much, do they?
Oh, they get attacked all the time. Unfortunately, we're seeing an awful lot of increased number of attacks. The last year on healthcare systems, there were about 25 attacks. This last year, it went up to 46 different health systems across the United States were hit with ransomware. And we'll talk more about ransomware in a minute, but it really disrupted them. And of these systems, there were 141 hospitals out there. So think of yourself in your clinics, in your hospital, in your inpatient or ambulatory space, where you were basically unable to service the patients that you want to take care of. That's how serious this is. And it's just increased. And the cost has increased. Unfortunately, it's really when you have something like ransomware, it's not the cost of the the fine or the cost of the payment if you make it. The breach itself is averaging about $11 million per data breach for each of these health systems. And that's really where the concern comes in. It's the disruption and the cost and the reputational harm that happens.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you talk about, you know, 46 attacks last year, and really what you're referring to is episodes in which the cyber criminals were successful in infiltrating a healthcare system. And I remember talking to John Brumfield, who was the prior CEO at University of Vermont Healthcare System. They were successfully hacked about 4 years or so ago about his experience with it. Now, since that hasn't happened to us, that means we're not getting attacked, right?
No, that's unfortunately not true.
Yeah.
So every health system gets attacked.
Yeah.
Literally last month, just at our firewall alone, there were over 4 million events, 4,855 and 620, to be honest, that hit our firewall that could be a potential attack. And one thing that I know folks are familiar with, the phishing program, that we test you each month with a test fish if you have an email account. And those fishes are very dangerous. In fact, that is part of what started many of these healthcare attacks, these healthcare system attacks for cyber attacks. And so you may not realize this, but we get about 22 million emails to our account holders, our email account holders here at MaineHealth every month. And of those, literally 90% of them are stripped away by our security tools before they even get to the junk box. They're filled and choked, these paths of communication, with hacking and scamming. And so our tools strip away all but about 10%, and we can't get all of them, but we're able to get as much as we can. And then we make sure that we get the... we address the other percentage that come through. We make sure that we put those into the junk box, and we set the filter somewhere so that you are able to get to the work that you need through the email. But still, some get through.
Yeah, and just to kind of highlight this, and I can't say this emphatically enough, we are constantly under attack by cyber criminals who are trying to infiltrate our healthcare system and do harm to us, do harm to our patients. And their hope is that we pay a ransom and they'll get wealthy doing this. And so every single day we're under attack, and there have been some pretty significant attacks that we've experienced. And so we had one a couple of months ago that breached a server and put us at risk. Now, fortunately, our systems kicked into gear, our cybersecurity systems, and prevented that from migrating and, you know, penetrating the rest of the system and shutting us down. But I think we did have to take a server offline. Is that correct?
And a number of different devices.
Yeah.
These kind of attacks start through some of the most innocuous ways, and this kind of goes to what my ask is or will be in this program, which is each of you who are listening to this today, who are part of MaineHealth, you have a role to play. This particular one started off with someone going to a fairly innocuous work site, maybe at lunch or whatever, and that website had been compromised. And it was not a website that you would be particularly concerned about, but it managed to download from that website onto one of our machines some malware, which is malicious software. And then the bad guys were off to the races. So it wasn't a case of individuals trying to come at us. It was a case of us going out and wandering into a minefield and bringing some of that badness home. And that's also similar to what happened at UVM over at what formerly Fletcher Allen over in Vermont. Individual was out with a laptop. They checked their personal mail and downloaded something from their homeowners association, opened a zip file. Inside was an executable file, and that executable file was malware.
Yeah.
And when they got back to the home mothership, back to their workplace, they connected to the network, and the bad guys were tied in. And that's where it all started and led to weeks and weeks of disruption, patient disruption, and downtime. And really, that's my message to you is that it's not the ransom. It's not the reputational piece. It's that we're sworn to take care of patients, and this malware will disrupt you and all that technology that we depend on every day to do our job in the clinical space gets disrupted, and you won't be able to have those conversations with the patients in the way that you want to, and you won't be able necessarily to be able to use the technology and tools like Epic that you want to. And if you have your lab down or your pharmacy down, that disrupts all of those processes as well. The orders process, the diagnostic process, and all the things that we hold dear to take care of the patients. And that's where the concern is. This malware called ransomware is terribly disruptive.
So if we had an attack like that, I mean, all you have to do is like run another program. It takes a few hours or a couple of days, and then we're back to normal, right?
Unfortunately not.
Yeah, no. And I think in my conversation with Dr. Brumstead, that was the thing that struck me the most. He said, you know, Andy, I thought, you know, this happened on a Friday. You know, I thought, oh, there go my weekend plans. It'll be a long weekend. We'll get through it. It'll be fine. But he said, boy, it just went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and patients were harmed because they couldn't get the care they needed, and it was incredibly traumatizing to all the workforce, all of their care team members, and it seemed like it would never end. And we had one hit close to home this summer as well, when the Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Insurance Company
right.
also suffered an attack, and again, it was a similar thing. It was months for them to finally get back to where every day seemed normal again, and so these things are traumatic. I'll share another story with you that happened to me. So I was about a year ago, I was at a conference with a number of other healthcare system CEOs, and we were talking about some important issues. And the gentleman sitting next to me from the healthcare system south of here, the CEO had to leave the room, and he looked a little bit agitated. And when he came back in, and I asked him what happened, and he said, well, my wife just got a phone call from someone with an accent who said that if I don't deposit $10 million into an account within the next 2 hours, they were going to begin releasing, lewd photos of patients,
wow.
you know, on the internet.
Wow.
And that's ultimately what they did. And so they were able to access the systems within the health system and get pictures of scout films that were appropriately taken for patients who are going to undergo radiation therapy, where they marked on the patients. But these were, of course, you know, sensitive areas of their anatomy that they then went and put on the internet. And then they notified all of the patients whose photos were on the internet that they were doing this, which just created all sorts of psychological trauma for everyone
Absolutely.
Involved. So these are really bad actors who are trying to do this, for sure. So what happens if, heaven forbid, this happens to us? And, you know, Dan Nygren, our chief information officer, and I have had some conversations where we've talked about, just given the environment we're in, mm-hmm. despite everyone trying to do the right thing, that it may be a matter, less of a matter of if or when, but how bad if it occurs. So what would happen if we get hacked?
Right. First, it depends on what the hack is. And our job at the outset is to identify what has happened and then contain it. So there is actually a security emergency incident response action that occurs. And we notify folks that we're starting this off. But that starts it off. And then we look at the technical side of it. Once containment has been done, that's basically just like in triage, that's limit the bleeding and stop the damage from getting worse. And then what we do next is we'll see what we can do technically to quarantine or separate any diseased or damaged, if you will, malware-infested parts of the network away from the rest of it. So salvaging as much as you possibly can. But it's quite possible that we have to prepare for the eventuality that we would have to separate MaineHealth or portions of MaineHealth from the internet, which is traumatic in and of itself because we're so dependent on it to talk to the outside for billing, for coordination, for anything. The next thing that has to happen is there's, of course, direct talk with you, with the executive leadership and with the emergency management team. And we work with the emergency management team to be able to make sure that the clinical side of this operation is also covered. What are the clinical effects and operational effects that are occurring in the inpatient and the ambulatory areas? We'll be working on the containment, the continuation of that, the diagnosis, the autopsy, if you will, of what happened, and then estimating what's going to be required to rebuild. At the same time, the ask, I think, that will be of everyone who's facing patients out there will be, if you're affected, what do you need to do to continue to provide that great clinical patient service, that healthcare that you've had? How are you interrupted? What can we do temporarily to make sure that we ease that interruption as much as possible from a technology perspective, and also give you some estimate of what it's going to take and how long it's going to be before we're back up and fully running again? So it'll depend on what's down, but if it is similar to UVM, could be basically you have to worry that it's going to be everything and that we'll be reduced to backup downtime procedures in order to care for patients in the inpatient area, and that the ambulatory areas need to be thinking very creatively about how they would contact patients to, like someone coming in for a colonoscopy. They've been through the prep. What are you going to tell them? How do we contact them if the phones are down? How do we reach out to them? How do they reach out to us? Those very real parts happen in the first really 6 to 24 hours, and then the long-term rebuild begins.
Yeah, and you know, that's part of the reason why we built a system-wide incident command system in the event that things like email are no longer available or telephones are no longer available, and how do we communicate together as a system to wall off parts of the system if we need to prevent something like this from occurring. So let's say I'm a practicing clinician, you know, physician, nurse, you know, advanced practice provider, respiratory therapist, physical therapist, and I'm, you know, in my clinical environment seeing patients. What can I do? How can I help in this and prevent the organization from getting attacked?
The most important thing is just to always think securely. Think about the actions that you're taking and protect that patient information, that confidential information. Maybe think of it as like a diamond that you want to, it's very precious, we want to protect it. It's also very dangerous, so maybe it's a radioactive diamond, but you want to protect this radioactive diamond of this patient data very carefully. So when you're doing your work, whether it is clinical frontline work or whether it's research work or whether it's educational work, just think about those things and always remember that taking care of the patient's data is part of taking care of the patient. And so protecting that PHI, thinking before you click, and also being mindful of when you're having those interactions through email or through texts or other things, treat it kind of like your home mail. I mean, if you didn't expect this email that's coming in from outside, it's junk mail. Treat it like you do when you go to the post office. Just throw the flyers, the junk away, and then open the stuff that you know or expect. And have a healthy skepticism. I think that's something that is kind of foreign to us a little bit in some ways because we're all about outreach. We're all about taking care of people. But think of it this way. Our patients come to us every day with their most difficult, hard to reveal, or anxious about talking about their physical or mental or whatever things that we can help them with in terms of making them better, making them healthier. And they're willing to give us that information so that we can do that. So my ask is that if they're willing to do that for us and to confide in us and to trust in us, then let's think very, very carefully about how we're using the patient information and protecting it in ways that both protect our organization but also are thoughtful of the patient. I think the golden rule applies, Andy. I think that it's how would you want your information as Andy Mueller protected? You would want it protected very, very well, very carefully, and not get out there. It's the same for everybody that we deal with every day that comes through our doors.
Well, yeah, no, and I appreciate the patient centricity of that. So at the end of the day, just to reiterate, it is less about the fact we may have to pay money. It's less about the fact that this may damage our reputation. It's more about the fact that in talking to other healthcare systems that have been infiltrated by some of these programs, it really harms patients ultimately, mm-hmm. and that's what we don't want to have happen, and it can harm them emotionally, psychologically through release of information, but can delay their care and really impact our ability to deliver care, which would be hard. And it's hard because we ask a lot of you to help keep us safe. That's why there's so many passwords. That's why I want to do double authentication. That's why we're limited on the number of interfaces we allow into Epic and other things. It's not because anyone is trying to say, no, it's not because we don't trust you all as our care team.
Right.
It's that we don't trust these bad actors who are out here. And these are evil people who are willing to do these things to healthcare systems and don't really care about the consequences in any way, shape, or form.
That's right.
And we're kind of at war with them. I mean, they're attacking us every day, trying to find just the littlest little chink in the armor. And just to give you a sense of that, when I was working in another state years ago, we had a very sophisticated private practice, big specialty practice of 130 physicians and even more APPs. This is a big time practice, super sophisticated. And they had a patient visit their clinic one day and decided that while they were waiting, they wanted to do some of their own personal work on the computer. So they inserted a flash drive into the computer, and that instantly infected the entire practice and shut them down for days, cost them millions of dollars, and again, prevented patients from getting needed care. And so we cannot be careful enough, for sure. And I just think talking to people, and if you talk to any of your colleagues who've been a part of a system that has been hacked, it is a gut-wrenching thing to listen to the stories that they tell us. So we want to try to avoid that to the degree that we can. And we may not be able to, despite all of the efforts that we're making to, just because these people are awfully insidious. So we talk a lot about the promise of artificial intelligence, and what that can potentially do for us in healthcare and help us provide better care for our patients and make our jobs easier in some ways. How does artificial intelligence impact these bad actors who want to do these things to us?
It's the jury's out so far. I'm not seeing the weaponization of AI, but I fear it. I think there's two pieces to this. One is think of AI as two separate types of models. There's the large language model, which I think we're familiar with ChatGPT, GPT-4, et cetera. And those are really cool technologies. They live off of what you feed them, and they feed on data. So my concern there is that as you're playing with AI, please don't play with it with PHI, with protected patient health information. It's just once it's gone, then the company that owns that particular tool has it, and it's not coming back. So it's not like sharing with a hospital. It's not like sharing with another provider. It's dangerous. That's the danger there. The promise of it, I think, is there is absolutely promise on the large language side, but I think that a lot of the promise we're seeing is on the clinical side for specialized products coming from some of our best vendors who are going to apply AI in some fantastic ways that will make the patient provider experience so much better and actually free up some time for you. I've seen some incredible demos going on recently, as have Dan Nygren and some of the other technology leaders. But I worry about that they're going to turn malware into more intelligent malware.
Yeah.
Right now, what happens, guys, is that when the malware gets inside your system, the bad guys need to be able to talk to it to direct it. It's like a 10,000-mile screwdriver. They're connecting to it, and they're saying, now I want you to go after this. Now I want you to scan and see what else you can connect to. Now I want you to do whatever. In the future, if they make more autonomous types of malware based on artificial intelligence that learns as it goes and then applies that knowledge to be able to steal more and then be more stealthy, that's what I'm worried about. Haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure there are nation states working on it right now.
Yeah, for sure.
And hackers who are not nation states.
So. Yeah. Well, I wish this was a little bit more of an uplifting topic. Andy, we're grateful that you're here and that you've got your team and working to keep us all safe. It's a big deal. And so just like we have to do the other things to care for our patients, positively identify our patients, wash our hands before engaging in care, we also need to make sure that we're doing everything we possibly can to keep our patients safe by preventing cyber attacks, which are a very real phenomena. So with that, maybe it's time for questions. So Caroline, you ready to join us again?
I am ready to join you again. And before we get to questions, I've got two things that I want to put out there. One of them, because I was going to save this to the end, but we've actually gotten a couple in here. We need to wish Andy S. a happy birthday.
Oh, that's right, it is his birthday today.
And we failed to do that at the beginning of the program. I meant to do that earlier. And then I got a couple of reminders from some of our viewers
right now.
So. Thank you. It's a great way to spend a birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thanks,
Absolutely.
Andy.
We'll let everybody out there sing to Andy.
Exactly. So I apologize for giving some of your personal information out here, but I figured you were probably okay with that. The other piece, before we get to the questions, we did want to let people know, because we get so many questions about the why behind MaineHealth's PTO policy, as well as the holiday policy, and, you know, what is going on, why did we make these changes, why do we do things the way we do. So the Andy's Open Door team reached out to HR and said, hey, how can we help people understand this better, because we get so many questions. And so what AQ section to the intranet site to help people understand that philosophy behind both the recent changes in the holiday schedule as well as the PTO policy. So if you have one of those why questions, you can go on that site, and if we scroll down a little bit, you're going to see that FAQ where it's talking about our paid time off policy as well as the holiday policy, some of those frequently asked questions. You can check that out and see if your question is answered. If your question is not answered, that intranet site also has information about how to contact the HR support center. So that way, if you do have additional questions or concerns about the PTO policy, how that holiday schedule impacts you personally, or how you're able to use your PTO, you can reach out to the HR support center to get some of your answers there. So hopefully that can help people out in the future, since we do get so many questions about that. And now to the questions for the program. And we did have one come in on the chat for Andy S. right off the top here. And Donna says, Andy Seward said, we all have to do our part, but how do those fishing exercises protect MaineHealth? She feels it seems like a distraction from clinical work, and just like someone's trying to trick her, and it doesn't feel good. So.
No, I and that's understandable. I mean, but think of it this way. We in healthcare, we're professionals. We train on everything. We train for safety. We train for hygiene. We train for practice. We train for procedure. The Joint Commission or someone comes and tests us. Why wouldn't we train on something that's as existential a threat as this? And since phishing emails are one of the biggest vectors for bringing in the badness, the malware, the malicious software, and starting off so many of these ransomware processes, it seems to me fair to train on it. And that's all that these are. These are training events in order to test us and to make us better. Now, some hospitals actually have a much more draconian way of doing this. I mean, I know of hospitals that have, like, you do this so many times and then it gets escalated as an event because you're acting in a way that is risky to the organization and could really disrupt the organization. We've taken more of a training bent to this, and also just thanking people and rewarding them and appreciating what they do when they answer. My ask of you is to embrace it. Embrace it. Try and find it. Make it a joke with your friends and say, yeah, you didn't trick me, security guys. I caught the fish. I see it. And we do different ones for different people. We used to do one type for everybody. Now we have 10 different ones that come out every month. And they are based on real phishing emails that were used to hack somebody in another organization. So they're realistic. Some of them have caught some of our folks, and hopefully we're learning from these as we go. My ask of you is that you also do this. Don't just embrace it. Also report it, because you don't really know whether it's a testing fish or whether it's a real fish. And so when you get one of these phishing emails, if you're suspicious, if it doesn't look right, if you weren't expecting it, there's a little button up at the top right that says report suspicious email. And now we've even put it in the banner of the email itself. You can click on it even on your phone. Just report it. That helps us too, because it teaches and trains our software to say, hey, Andy Mueller got that one. Now I'll make sure that nobody else on this call gets it. So it learns as it goes as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and we debated this as to whether or not to do this, because I realize for many of you it feels like you're trying to trick you, or, you know, punitive, or a kind of waste of time. But there's good evidence to suggest that organizations that do this are less likely to be hacked. And again, this is really about protecting our patients. And so we made the decision to do this, and at the same time didn't want to punish people either. You know, we decided to take a training bent around this and do this. And I get them, I report them, I hit that button on the top right because it helps me learn and understand, and I want to make sure I'm doing everything I can to help protect the organization. And I just view it as part of sort of the training on my job, just trying to continuously get better, because the criminals are continuously trying to get better.
Exactly.
To trick us.
Thank you for your question. Appreciate that one.
Yeah, and I wonder if by training people and sending this out, it actually does make you more suspicious of emails that come in, because you know it. Well, it might be the organization trying to get you, it might be somebody else, but not every email that's going to be coming in is one. It just gives you a more critical eye, I'm wondering, if that's part of it as well.
I think it makes me have heightened awareness of it. I pay attention more now, I think, because we do it.
Yeah, and again, healthy skepticism, it's okay. Have that, you know, did I expect this? Do I want this? Is this something I was expecting? Just think before you click, and I think that it'll go better that way.
Yeah.
Good information, though, also that actually clicking the fish button and not just deleting is helpful to your team, too.
Yeah. And if I could just add, yeah, if you don't report it, at least delete it. And I would also add, when you're at home, that same healthy skepticism pays off with your family, with your kids, with, you know, just you have a home computer. All these tips and tricks are the same, and they try and scam you at home, too.
One of the questions that I told you, Andy, that I had for you, and because I know that a couple of my colleagues, and it may be just because we live in the communications world, so we are really, you know, relying on trying to get information out and hit firewalls a lot and go, oh, geez, why, you know, why, is can you talk a little bit about how you determine what you do block off from fire? Like, what is enough of a safety concern that we need to block access to this web page or this this plugin to your email, as opposed to things that, okay, well, there, you know, we need to be careful about how we use this, but access is okay because we do need this to do our job. How do you find that line when you're looking at security?
Yeah, it's really a risk determination line, isn't it? And a regulatory one too. We're still bound by HIPAA. We're bound by the laws of state of New Hampshire and Maine because we operate in those spaces. There's a regulatory piece to this, but there's also a piece to this in terms of the risk of it. And so we have some fairly sophisticated tools that can determine whether this is a risky thing or not. We have tools that can detect PHI that's being sent, and we can then try and stop that if necessary from going out if it wasn't by someone who has the rights to be able to do that. So we control it both through access, and we also control it according to the law and regulation. And we use our tools to also try and find any of the malware that might be trying to move through the network, because it can attach itself like a hitchhiker to different things and start to move around. This whole thing is about risk, and we have a risk section. And we analyze those risks every day. And we even have external, just like the Joint Commission comes and judges or tests us, we are tested every year by an outside auditor who comes in and assesses us in terms of our security program. And they even do what's called penetration testing, where they sit outside and they do ethical hacking, where they try and hack us and try and get into our systems. And so we then take the risks that we learn from these exercises, and then we say, well, we're going to work on those. This one's critical. This one's kind of low. We'll work on the critical one first. We assign it to someone, and we come up with an action plan for how we're going to work on those. And then we brief them appropriately up to the audit committee of the board, so they are informed as well. The CIO gets to know, the CFO gets to know. And so we're very open about these risks. We want everyone to understand that they do happen, and we do have a very methodical way of addressing them as you're doing that. Now, one thing that you did say, Caroline, I do want to address that. We are always going to frustrate some people. I understand that, but we are in the business of being conservative and protecting. That's what we do. There's always a natural tension here. The trick is to find the right balance between the two. And at the end of the day, the organization's operations rule out. It's a decision on risk that we need to appropriately bring forward and say, we can do this, but it has this level of risk. Do you want to do this? And if we do it, then we take that risk as an organization. We move forward. We're not just sitting there in some back room, you know, cutting things off. So
you're not twisting your mustache and saying,
we do not diabolically twist our mustache.
No. I'm just teasing. No, and I don't think anybody does. We did get a fun comment here from Helen. Helen said, I think it would be a fun challenge among teams throughout Maine Health if we could somehow track how successful teams are throughout the month, quarter, or year in identifying phishing emails. It would be a little team challenge to see who could click that button the most times. So that's a fun suggestion.
Yeah, by the way, the new phishing tool does allow us, we are now providing to the organizations through the regional CIOs the information on which organizations are doing particularly well or maybe not so well across Maine Health, and we can rate ourselves against each other. Our hope in the future is that we would be able to do that to an even finer level so that you would know as a leader or as a member of a group how we're doing.
And then be able to educate more accordingly. Mm-hmm. We do have a couple of questions here, an email that are unrelated to security, but certainly if people are watching and they have some more questions, please get those in the chat now before we get done for the day. We got a question from someone who works in access to care and specifically on the insurance side, helping people with insurance, commenting that there is such a long wait time right now for access to mental health care, as we know, and there can be a long wait for a main care determination to help people for insurance. She was concerned for people who might come back to the hospital because they don't get access to care on the front end that's necessary for their success. And she heard a story on NPR about Wyoming, where they've opened a mental health urgent care in their capital city. And she was wondering if this is something that Maine Health would consider.
Yeah, possibly. And so Kelly Barton, who leads our Maine behavioral health team, has been conducting a pretty significant, her and the team have been conducting a pretty significant inventory of what we have available, where the gaps are in the services we have, and we recognize there's huge gaps in everything between just, you know, counseling with a counselor all the way to, you know, ultimately being admitted to the hospital. And so we're looking at those, trying to think about how we're going to stage the investments that need to be made, and also having conversations with the state, because this is such an enormous problem. We won't be able to solve it all on our own. We're going to need help in solving this. And so more to come on that front, but I do think that you're going to ultimately see some new opportunities for behavioral health care delivery.
Heidi was commenting as we implemented some masking in some areas and some circumstances once again. She wanted to know why it is that we all still need to be getting our flu shots, one, and two, why aren't we requiring patients to mask?
Okay, yeah, good question. So really the answer to both of those things is it's kind of a law. And so in the state of Maine, we're required by law to get flu shots if we're engaged in patient care. And we don't have the ability to change that. We need to be legally compliant. At the same time, it's still a good idea. And I think part of the reason why is the flu is so highly contagious. You can be asymptomatic for up to a couple of weeks and still be contagious to patients and not realize you're going to get the flu. And so it's part of that real reason for trying to ensure that our workforce is appropriately immunized. And the hope is that not every year we are going to have to wear masks. And so continuing to get the flu shot will be valuable in those circumstances. As to patients, we really can't force them or require them to wear masks as much as we can ask them to. And so we feel it's the appropriate stance to do just that, to ask them if they would be willing to mask.
And Carrie wanted to know if Maine Health would consider providing care team members with COVID tests, because the government issue ones, if you use those all up already, suddenly you have to be spending money out of pocket for your COVID tests.
Yeah, we'd have to explore that. The reality is, as with any of these things, there's only been so many pennies to go around. And I think as most of you realize, we've lost money the last couple of years. And so as we've looked to make investments in the things that we need to, cybersecurity, also your income and paycheck and those types of things and all the other things that we need to care for our patients, we'd have to balance it against all of those things. So it's certainly something I can take back to the team, have us look at, and then we'll have to balance that against the other needs of the organization.
All right, that is what I have for questions. So thank you, Andy S., for joining us.
A pleasure.
And happy birthday again.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you.
And I love your recognition, because you are recognizing people today that are security superstars, right? So show us who you've got to recognize today.
Sure. There's three, really. We have Dr. Cornelius Ferreira is the chief medical officer at MHMG, and a super supporter and very thoughtful thought leader of security. He's such a multi-talented man. He jumped in on a couple of issues around phishing and also around just protecting data, and has become a stalwart supporter because he understands the risk here, and he understands the balance and trying to strike the right balance. And we're very grateful for his leadership in this area. If we had a personal hero for some of the members of my team, it would be Dr. Callie Varakles. When she was running the residence program, she was absolutely remarkable in the fact that she detected that we literally had some folks who were doing things with data that they shouldn't have, even though they've been told they shouldn't. And she stopped everything and said, I need to stop everything with that data movement. Mentors, you need to come in with your residents. We need to talk through this, and I need to make it absolutely crystal clear that this is not okay. And I think that's the kind of leadership. It didn't disrupt things very long, but it made the point, and it changed the behavior, and it changed the thought, and kind of opened some minds around how we treat this patient information. We understand that residents need to do their projects. We understand that they need to do these things to go forward. But she took real leadership in this, and so we're very grateful to her. And then the last one is, on the IT team, we sometimes don't think about these folks that are out on the front lines, at the pointed edge, tip of the spear, just taking care of people and helping them with their IT and technology. And that's the field services team that works for Patty von Eiderstein and some of her crew. They, for example, Andy talked about a recent event that we had. They came in on a weekend, pulled machines off the network to make sure that they were safe and secure. They go the extra mile, and they're the ones that you see in the clinical spaces making sure that you're up and running. And so they've always got that security mindset in addition to let's keep it running. So let's keep it going, but also securely. We wanted to thank them today.
Yeah, Andy, thank you. Thank you for being here with us, and thank you and all of those individuals who are cybersecurity heroes in helping make sure that our patients are protected. Also have some great patient experience accolades today. So want to start with the first one for Memorial Hospital's emergency department. A parent wrote, "The emergency department team was fast and efficient from the moment we arrived. They were so patient and kind to my daughter, who was being more stubborn than normal because of how she was feeling. They just redirected and took another approach to make her more comfortable and cooperate. Being in the emergency room as a small child is a terrifying experience, but this team was amazing and it made a pleasant experience. Thank you to all of the staff for taking such good care of my baby girl. You guys are the real MVPs, and for sure they are. It's a wonderful team in the emergency department at Memorial." In addition to that, our other recognition is for Nancy Masuko from Memorial's radiology department. A patient wrote, "I had a mammogram and worked with Nancy. She is dedicated, professional, knowledgeable, and a real team player. She goes the extra mile and is very empathetic. She has worked a long time in her role and is very good at it. Nancy is an asset to Memorial Hospital and Maine Health. Nancy, you are. Thanks for living our value of patient-centered." Okay, next open door will be February 7th. In the meantime, you know, I've been hiding an Easter egg here on the set. Nobody's commented on it at all. So I'm hoping at some point somebody catches on and makes a comment about that. And I'll keep doing that for the next programs. In addition to that, of course, before we see you back next time, make sure you're positively identifying the patient in front of you and washing your hands before engaging in care. Thanks a bunch, and we'll see you next time.